Ayatollah Khamenei says Iran is a victim of maritime piracy. By seizing the Greek tankers, it has indeed taken back what it rightfully owned. Iran says that a visit by the IAEA chief to Israel just ahead of a meeting of the Board of Governors could erode the agency's credibility. And 100 days into the war in Ukraine, both Moscow and Kyiv renew their pledges to fight on for victory. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Thousands of Iranians have converged on the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini to mark the anniversary, 33 years ago, of the passing away of the late leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Yusuf Jalali has filed this report.
The father of the Islamic Revolution is how these Iranians remember Imam Khomeini on the 33rd anniversary of his passing. Congregating at his mausoleum in south of Tehran, Iranians once again paid tribute to Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic and the former leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which put an end to centuries of autocracy in Iran. As with every year, incumbent leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressed the nation. Imam Khomeini passed away in 1989 at the age of 86, almost a decade after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which saw the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime in Iran, headed by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, known as the Shah. Imam Khomeini spent many years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement which ultimately ousted the Shah and led to the formation of the Islamic Republic, something which these people believe did not sit well with the West.
Imam Khomeini sought to free the country from foreign powers that had exploited our country's resources, including our oil. It's obvious that the revolution cut off the West's access to our resources, and that's why they've ever since been trying to deal a blow to the Islamic establishment.
People here view the revolution as an ideology, a legacy from Imam Khomeini that needs to be preserved against all odds, including the economic hardship that exists in Iran.
Inflation and high prices do exist here, which I hope will soon be solved, but this does not mean that we should abandon what we fought for back then. Our people gave blood to lead the revolution to victory, and we must preserve it.
We are the fourth generation of the Islamic Revolution, and we have come here to show the world that we will never turn our back on the revolution and our leader.
Imam Khomeini established the Islamic Republic following a referendum held in 1979, when, based on official reports, more than 98% of eligible Iranians voted yes to the Islamic Republic.
More than three decades after his passing, Imam Khomeini is still remembered as a man who changed the course of history in Iran, with ambitions for freedom and independence. People here believe his call for an independent Iran has been materialized, despite all of the economic and political pressures exerted by the West against Iran, which seek to isolate the Islamic Republic. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Political commentator Sarfaz Ruhollah Rezvi says Imam Khomeini's stance on the issue of Palestine highlighted the importance of Muslims' unity against Israel.
Imam fought against the Shah regime inside Iran, and at the same level, he fought against the geopolitics that was going on at the West Asian region. For that, we have to understand the role that Imam played for the cause of Palestine and against the Zionist regime. We should understand the context in which Imam Khomeini came with the revolution. Of course, Imam, the one who was leading the revolution of the Iranian people, the one who was actually the spirit of the revolution of the Iranian people, What he was thinking and how he was analyzing the existence of the Zionist regime at the region. For that, we have to go back to the speeches, statements of Imam Khomeini years before 1979 revolution. So when we go through those sentences, those phrases, those statements, we understand how Imam was, you know, precisely understanding the main problem of the region and how Imam understood what so many scholars, so-called, you know, professors and the expertise in the geopolitics of different countries at the West Asian region were not able to understand. That was Israeli regime and the creation of the Israel from 1948 by the support of the West by the support of the United Nations, and specifically by the support of the United States of America, how it was going to change the geopolitics of the West Asian region. And Imam Khomeini was the person who was giving notice. He was who was actually trying to awake the people and awake the politicians at the same time, awake the people and the politicians years before the revolution, that let's understand what is going on in our region.
Political commentator Sayyid Mostafa Khoshchashm says that Imam Khomeini taught new political ideas to the Muslim world.
Imam Khomeini brought new ideas and blew hope to the Muslim world community, to the people throughout the world. He brought new political thoughts, he brought new ideas and new pattern of life. He gave courage to the people and showed them a new path, and he inspired many throughout the world he actually brought a new pattern that's still being developed and followed by millions throughout the world. He showed that if you mean to rise really and stand integrated and united, you could have your own independent sovereign states against all the pressures that you might endure from the West and from the powers of the world. You still can resist the tyrants, and you still can represent new ideas to the world. So he was an inspiring character in every possible way, not only for religious people, but also for those outside the domain and domain of Islam and outside Muslim territories.
Tehran reacts after the controversial visit by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency to Israel, days after criticism of Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Iran's foreign ministry warns of further erosion of the agency's credibility, while its Director General kept silent on Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. The ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says this questions the IAEA's impartiality. Iran is one of the signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel, however, has never signed up to that treaty, which aims to ensure the civilian use of nuclear technology. The regime backs the draft resolution prepared by the U.S. and its allies to rebuke Iran by the IAEA Board of Governors. Tehran has warned against any unconstructive action at the upcoming meeting of the body, saying that it will respond immediately and proportionately. Thousands of Yemenis take to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities, including Sada and Hajjah, in a public display of the nation's resolve against the Saudi-led war on the country. Demonstrators with Yemen's flag chanted slogans against the aggressors and their key ally, the U.S. The Yemenis were on the streets to make it clear to the enemies that their country will remain independent and free. The demonstrations were held in honor of the late founder of the Ansarullah movement, Hussein al-Houthi. The demonstrators also slammed dishonest calls for peace made by certain Arab governments that have normalized relations with the Israeli regime. The Yemenis reiterated their support for the Palestinian cause. The UN envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, says parties of the war in Yemen have agreed to extend the truce for another 2 months. Analysts say that the agreement could pave the way for ending the conflict. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
Following intense UN-supervised meetings between the warring sides in Yemen, the UN envoy for Yemen announced that the parties have agreed to renew the current truce in Yemen for 2 more months. The truce is extended under the same terms as the original agreement, which first came into effect on the 2nd of April.
When the United Nations agreed to our conditions, which included releasing the salaries of government employees, we saw that it was our duty to respond to the renewal of the truce, although we were aware that the enemy would not respect the truce as it did previously. But we adhere to peaceful solutions and we will make concessions in order to end the war.
Observers say renewing the truce is a win for the Yemenis, who stood alone during 7 years of war without any support from the international community or the United Nations.
The United Nations was absent throughout the years of war, and the armistice is not an achievement for the international body, but rather a success for Sana'a, which remained alone in facing war and siege without any support from the international community or any allies.
Grundberg said he will continue engaging with the parties to implement and consolidate all elements of the truce.
people, he hoped that renewing the UN brokered truce will build for a comprehensive political solution to end the war that devastated their lives and country. They say the international community should now step in properly to support the political process in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Turkey is gearing up for another major incursion into northern Syria territory, despite international outcry. Ankara has in the past launched several offensives in the war-ravaged Arab country under the pretext of fighting Kurdish militants. But this time, Turkey's ties with the United States and Russia are at stake.
Tensions are once again rising in northern Syria as Turkey threatens to conduct a major military operation there. Ankara says it wants to establish a 30-kilometer safe zone along the Syrian border and push back terrorists. Turkey has long been fighting members of the People's Protection Units, YPG, a U.S.-backed Kurdish militia it deems a terrorist group. Since 2016, Turkey has carried out three major incursions inside the Syrian territory under the same pretext, the latest of which came in October 2019, which fell short of ending in creating the buffer zone Ankara was hoping for. In the meantime, Damascus has slammed the Turkish plan as an act of aggression and an extension of Ankara's policy of ethnic cleansing in the area.
Turkey has been notorious for smuggling oil and engaging in oil theft in Syria. It has been launching military operations into Syria. It is indeed shot down and killed Russian military members in Syria. So Turkey has ambitions to expand its political footprint and reconquer parts of Syria that it lost after World War I in the Sykes-Picot Act, which the French and the British carved up the Middle East after World War I.
Syria says the measures taken by Turkey have caused civilian casualties and done massive damage to public and private property, including critical infrastructure. Syria describes Turkey's offensive as a shameful act of aggression that has displaced dozens of families from their homes and villages.
Turkey's planned measure comes as Russia has withdrawn a significant number of its troops from Syria amid the ongoing war in Ukraine. Ankara may be planning to fill the vacuum, but how can it justify its presence in Syria when it does not have the approval from Damascus to station its troops there? The Syrian government has repeatedly slammed Turkey for its military move in northern Syria.
Russia has urged Turkey to refrain from launching an offensive into northern Syria, saying it could lead to a dangerous deterioration of the already difficult situation. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman said such a move would be a direct violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Maria Zakharova added that an incursion by Turkey could cause a further escalation of tensions in Syria. Iran's foreign ministry made a similar statement warning of humanitarian disasters and heightened tensions in the region. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said while the Islamic Republic understands Turkey's security concerns, the only way to alleviate those concerns is through dialogue and respect for bilateral agreements with neighbors. Turkey's face-off against the YPG would put Ankara in an uneasy position with the United States, which considers the Kurdish militia a major ally inside Syria. U.S. State Department on Tuesday said Washington condemns any escalation and supports the existing ceasefire lines in the area.
Well, the United States certainly has backed the Kurdish operations to carve up Syria, to carve up Iraq, to basically split, divide, and conquer that whole region into ethnic strife and competition. That is one of the sore points between the U.S. and Turkey is the Kurds, because Turkey sees them as an enemy to be destroyed, whereas the U.S. sees the Kurds as a pawn, as a tool to use in destabilizing Syria, President Bashar Assad, and create endless civil war and conflict there.
Russia, Iran, and Turkey are the guarantors of the Astana peace process and have been mediating peace negotiations between the Syrian government and the opposition since 2017. Any rifts between the three could derail the talks and damage any progress they have achieved.
...100 days into the war in Ukraine, Russia says that it will continue its military operation until all of its goals are achieved. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says one of Moscow's main goals is to protect the people of the self-proclaimed republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. With war raging in eastern Ukraine, Peskov says Russia has achieved certain results. He says these include what he called liberation of some areas from Ukrainian military control. However, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky pushed back, pledging victory against Russian forces. Moscow launched a military operation in Ukraine on February 24. It came after the U.S. and its allies ignored Moscow's complaints about NATO's expansion near Russian borders. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight. Colorado lawsuit charges group with questioning residents about voting status, while former U.S. President Donald Trump loyalists work to sustain falsehoods about his loss. We are prepared for an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, Groups Perpetuating Trump's 2020 Election Lie Face Scrutiny and Lawsuits. Conservative groups perpetuating Donald Trump's false charges that the 2020 election was rigged have sparked a lawsuit against one in Colorado and a congressional panel investigation of another in New Mexico over aggressive tactics used to seek out possible voter fraud. The scrutiny and criticism facing these conservative groups underscore how Donald Trump loyalists in several U.S. states are working to sustain falsehoods about Trump's election loss, while launching new drives that voting rights advocates say smack of voter intimidation, often targeting communities of color. A lawsuit was filed by the National Association for Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, and two other groups in March of this year, charging that Colorado-based U.S. Election Integrity Plan, which has echoed Donald Trump's baseless claims about 2020 election fraud, has gone door-to-door in some counties, aggressively questioning residents about their voting status and sometimes bearing arms. Moreover, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform has been investigating EcoMail, a firm that helped push false claims of election fraud in Arizona, and has reportedly been paid $50,000 by a New Mexico county to oversee a local audit force doing intrusive door-to-door voter canvassing. Other states, including Michigan and Utah, boast conservative groups that, under the guise of protecting voting integrity by ferreting out fraud, have been criticized for the methods they employed in seeking out potential voter fraud. Danielle Lang, Senior Director of Voting Rights at the Nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center, said, "As Americans, we expect and demand an open and participatory democracy that welcomes all voters equally. She added, those engaging in these pressure tactics should know that voter intimidation is a crime with serious consequences. The lawsuit against U.S. election integrity plan filed by the NAACP in Colorado, the League of Women Voters in Colorado, and My Familiar Voter charges that the U.S. election integrity plan has engaged in door-to-door voter intimidation, including taking pictures of some houses in neighborhoods with a large number of minority residents. The lawsuit charges that the U.S. Election Integrity Plan, or USEIP, representatives have at times worn badges or carried firearms when visiting voters' residences, although they're not government officials. Beth Hendricks, the League of Women Voters executive director in Colorado, told The Guardian, "We're very concerned about reports that Colorado voters have received visits at their homes from people sometimes openly armed, posing as government officials who imply, without evidence, that fraudulent voting activity occurred at their address." A Colorado judge recently rejected a motion by USEIP, the U.S. Election Integrity Plan, to dismiss the lawsuit. A separate motion by the plaintiff's two counsels, the nonprofit legal group Free Speech for People and the law firm Lathrop GPM, to obtain a preliminary injunction to halt U.S. Election Integrity Plan's efforts is pending. The lawsuit partly rests on a measure that passed after the Civil War called the KKK Act or the Ku Klux Klan Act, aimed at stopping white terrorists from using violence to interfere with black voters. The Colorado-based U.S. Election Integrity Plan, or USEIP, which started after Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump, is run by Sean Smith, a retired Air Force colonel who also leads Cause of America, a nationwide group that boasts that its role is to enable, facilitate, and support citizen grassroots action to restore trust in local elections. Mike Lindell, the multimillionaire Trump loyalist, who is the chief executive officer of MyPillow and has been the chief financier of Cause of America, told The Guardian that the group serves as an information hub with a presence in all 50 states and on his website, frankspeech.com. Mike Lindell estimated he has spent between $100,000 and $200,000 monthly for salaries for the group's employees, except for Smith, who is unpaid, and other expenses. Smith was reportedly tapped by Mike Lindell to run Cause of America last fall, after Smith attended a Lindell-organized cyber symposium last summer in South Dakota, which promoted conspiratorial and baseless claims of voting fraud in the 2020 presidential election. An organizing manual for the U.S. Election Integrity Plan thanks Mike Lindell, but he told The Guardian that he had no ties with it. Smith can be seen in a 39-second video clip in a large crowd of Trump loyalists who were at the Capitol during the 6th of January assault, and another photograph that was released by Colorado Newsline and relied on ProPublica research. Smith did not reply to emails sent to Cause of America seeking comment. Other outfits with track records for claiming the 2020 election was rigged have popped up in New Mexico, where ostensibly, in the name of ferreting out voting fraud, they have sparked concerns about intimidating voters in areas with large minority populations. Top Democrats on the House Committee on Oversight and Reform in March announced an investigation into charges from state officials that EcoMail was retained by Tiny Otero County to examine potential voting fraud, in part by overseeing a door-to-door voter canvass. The founder of EcoMail, V.A. Shiva Ayadurai, has been a frequent promoter of unfounded conspiracies about the 2020 presidential election results, as well as a Senate primary in Massachusetts that he lost. And the firm was also a subcontractor for a widely debunked Arizona audit of its largest county. According to records obtained and published by the watchdog group American Oversight, and first reported by NBC News, EcoMail's contract called for it to supervise a door-to-door voter canvass by a group called the New Mexico Audit Force to check the accuracy of voter rolls. The company's contract also said it would inspect ballot images in the county and assess voter signatures for accuracy. The House Oversight Committee Chair, Carolyn Maloney, and the chair of its Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, Jamie Raskin, wrote Ayadurai in March that it is investigating whether your company's audit and canvass in New Mexico interferes with Americans' right to vote by spreading disinformation about elections and by intimidating voters. The House letter pointed out that 40% of the county's residents are non-white Hispanic and raised the concern that the company's canvass could have a particular impact on minority communities in Otero County. Otero County, which has a population of 67,000 people, was won by Donald Trump by more than 25% of the vote in the 2020 presidential election. In response, V.A. Shiva Ayadurai denied EcoMail was playing any such role in Otero County and did not provide requested documents, promoting another letter to Ayadurai with evidence and statements from a New Mexico couple involved in the audit force. A committee spokesperson told The Guardian that Dr. Ayadurai has denied EcoMail's participation in the sham audit and canvass, directly contradicting statements made by leaders of the New Mexico Audit Force and raising serious doubts about his credibility. The spokesperson added the panel is now weighing its next moves to get to the bottom of this so-called audit and prevent other attacks on our elections. The Oversight Committee also wrote in March to Justice Department Assistant Attorney General Kirsten Clark of the Civil Rights Division to share his concerns about possible negative impacts of EcoMail's Otero County efforts. On a related voting front, Congresswoman Maloney told The Guardian in a statement that another investigation she launched recently with Congresswoman Zoe Loughran, the chair of the House Administration Committee, is looking into election disinformation in Arizona, Florida, Ohio, and Texas. This is a fight for our democracy, and I'm committed to finding solutions. Daniel Lang of the Campaign Legal Center stressed that groups trying to find fraud while harassing voters or spreading disinformation won't succeed and will be challenged. Lang said, "The right to vote is the bedrock of our society, and voters won't be bullied out of exercising their rights."
Africa Today.
The United Nations says Africa faces an unprecedented crisis following the military conflict in Ukraine that has led to soaring food and fuel prices. Now, unilateral Western sanctions on Russia are also disrupting supplies of wheat, fertilizer and other goods, compounding the difficulties Africa already faces from climate change and the coronavirus pandemic. Now, despite the grim situation, the president of the African Development Bank Group says Africa is ready to face the impact of the Ukraine conflict.
When COVID struck, we were not ready. But this time, we are fully ready, and we will avert a food crisis, and we will avert also the impact on inflation. But we do need the money to be able to very quickly intervene and get it done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, this week, you're focusing on how the ongoing conflict in Ukraine is impacting on Africa. Now, the severe impact arising from the crisis in Ukraine is expected to have major implications for livelihoods and businesses across Africa. We are asking, how are African countries mitigating this crisis? In the second part of our program, we shall get acquainted with the humanitarian activities of the Red Crescent Society of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Africa. Our guest in the studio will be telling us how they are having a positive impact on the lives of people in Africa.
Ukraine's conflict impact on Africa. United Nations Africa Development Programme Chief Economist for Africa, Raymond Gilpin, says the conflict in Ukraine has ignited an unprecedented crisis for Africa. Rising prices and a slump in economic growth are putting millions of households at risk across the continent. A big number of countries in Africa rely heavily on food imports and fertilizer from Russia and Ukraine.
UN's Food and Agriculture Organization chief economist Maximo Torero gives a glimpse here on why the conflict in Ukraine will affect food security in the world.
We know that the world is highly concentrated in terms of exports of cereals, so very few countries have a significant share of the exports to the world. Ukraine and Russia Federation, we are talking that together they represent one-third of the world's cereal exports. Not only that, Russia represents 55% of the production of sunflower, and they are also key exporter of fertilizers.
Now, for more on how the conflict in Ukraine is affecting food security in Africa, we contacted Tshepo Magama, a political activist and a former member of South African Parliament. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us.
Thank you.
Mr. Magama, can you briefly tell us how is the conflict in Ukraine impacting on food security in Africa?
Of course, it impacts food security in a major way on the continent. Of course, as you would know that Africa imports a lot of its wheat and other barley products from Russia and Ukraine in particular. And so this is creating, serious problems, especially in light of the fact that Russia has now indicated that they would stop all, wheat exports. But to that extent, the African Union, about 2 weeks ago, held a special session where the Commission agreed that the chairman of the Commission would then, of the African Union, in fact, would visit the Russian president and government to deal with this particular matter, to ameliorate the difficulties that may arise out of this conflagration.
African countries are already taking measures to mitigate the current wheat shortage by turning to indigenous solutions. To counter the current wheat shortage in his country, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is calling on citizens to eat cassava as an alternative to bread.
There will be no bread. If there's no bread, eat mhogo. Mhogo is here. What is the problem? Huh? Africans really confuse themselves. You are crying that there is no wheat. I don't eat bread myself. If there's no bread, eat mhogo. Mhogo is here.
How are the governments in Africa coping with disruption in food and fertilizer supplies? And should we expect more instability in the coming months?
There are a lot of things that are going on at the moment. But of course, the disruption is going to be there. And I think it behoves the African continent now to really put in place, the necessary processes to shield itself to the extent that it possibly can, given, of course, its dependencies on imports, especially of basic food and energy, of its energy resources.
Africa remains a net importer of food. Yet, according to some estimates, it has 60% of the world's uncultivated arable land. In an effort to boost agriculture, the African Development Bank has approved a $1.5 billion facility to help African countries avert a looming food crisis in the continent.
The plan will provide 20 million farmers with improved seeds and fertilizers to produce 38 million metric tons of food.
Can the conflict in Ukraine be a silver lining that will spur Africa's agricultural potential?
This must be seen, in both historical and contemporary context. You will recall that, Africa had been placed under tremendous pressure by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank in terms of liberalization and the privatization of its, state-owned capacity for food production in particular. And so the idea then, of course, by these neo-colonialist institutions was really to focus Africa's primary resources and capacities on the export of raw materials.
The United States has passed a law to counter Russia in Africa by tracking its military operations, investments, and businessmen. Some analysts believe that the legislation is partly because many African countries chose to stay neutral on UN resolutions on Russia's military operations in Ukraine. Now, Mr. Magama, do we expect African countries to defy sanctions imposed by the US and Europe on Russian companies?
Africa is a resilient continent. We have also seen during the time of the Soviet Union and, of course, the times when African liberation movements were struggling against, European and U.S. imperialism on the African continent, that Africans have aligned themselves with the Soviet Union and other progressive and socialist forces across the world, despite the pressures put on these movements and countries by the U.S. government. And so what this will require, of course, will be for the African, for Africans and African governments in particular, to use the institutions of the African Union, and in particular the principle of African unity, to find ways to push back against this new onslaught of imperialism of the U.S. Through laws such as this, and of course these extraterritorial illegal sanctions.
Now, African countries that heavily depend on imported crude oil and petroleum have been badly affected by the Ukraine crisis as prices increase sharply. Now, to prevent civil unrest, governments are explaining to their citizens that skyrocketing fuel prices have been caused by the events in Ukraine. Tanzanian President Samia Suluhu Hassan has urged members of parliament to tell the citizens the truth.
We have decided that the levy be reinstated, but members of parliament with constituents and members supervising various sectors should tell citizens the truth, that the Russia-Ukraine conflict has caused a steep hike in fuel prices, and that when fuel prices go up, everything else goes up.
During the United Nations General Assembly vote on Russia's military operation in Ukraine, many African countries did not support Western powers in what was seen as an indicator of Russia's increasing power on the continent.
And my last question to you, Mr. Magama. Now, what will be the long-term impact of the Ukraine conflict in terms of geopolitics, particularly considering the fact that Russia has started to make inroads in Africa?
There are strategic choices that the African continent, has to make. But that said, the African continent also runs the risk, of course, of being merely co-opted, as it was, during the Cold War period to serve the interests, of global powers. It's a choice that the African continent has to make. But there are much more opportunities, objectively, that accrue to the African continent if it takes the appropriate, decisions. But of course, decisions that will require the African continent.
We'd like to thank Tshetso Magema, a South African political analyst, for his insight. And as he said, African leaders will have to decide on the status of Africa in the emerging global political realignments. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall be discussing about the humanitarian activities of Iran's Red Crescent Society in Africa. The Iranian Red Crescent Society provides direct medical services to people in several African countries, including Ivory Coast, Sierra Leone, Ghana, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Mali, and Niger. Now, Iran's Red Crescent Society also provides humanitarian services to many parts of Africa, and this assistance has saved lives and brought hope and smiles in the faces of many across the continent. Now, to discuss more on this, we are joined here by Dr. Hassan Isfandiar. He's the Director General for International Operations and Humanitarian Programs at the Iranian Red Crescent Society. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Yeah, it's a big opportunity for me, and also I need to appreciate you and all of your colleagues who provide this opportunity for me to discuss about the humanitarian programs of the Iranian Red Crescent in African continent. Let me start my word by saying that the Iran Red Crescent Society is the largest humanitarian organization inside Iran, which is mandated to respond to any sort of disasters taking place in the country, and also if it is necessary to have international operations out of the country, it is the Iran Red Crescent who deploys to different countries to provide humanitarian assistance. For Africa, it is really important for us to be present there and to provide humanitarian assistance to the people, no matter where they are or no matter whom they are. So the only criteria we have to provide humanitarian assistance is just the requirements, the needs, and also, as you mentioned in your introduction, to bring a smile to the face of the people in different countries.
Okay, now thanks. What are some of the major programs or projects you have in Africa?
Yeah, the approach of the Iranian Red Crescent Society to provide humanitarian services is coming in two directions. The first one is the emergency operations, which taking place and happens during the emergency time. So no matter what kind of disaster they are, for example, in Africa, we are facing the hunger issues, we are facing the drought, we are facing different floods, and then recently we have different sort of the diseases like the COVID-19 we faced, and then before that we had, in West of Africa, in malaria or the other types of the Ebola and the other types of the diseases. So normally when we go to Africa and we deploy our resources, either it is for the emergency purposes or for the, let's say, long-term or permanent services, which at the center of them are the health issues.
So you've been quite successful, I think, in your projects and programs in Africa,
I could say that the IRCS has been activated its activities in Africa more than 30 years ago. For example, I remember that Ghana was one of the first countries that we have gone, and then in 1991 we were in Ghana, which is almost exceed more than 30 years. So comparing those programs, projects, activities, and the issues we had, I can say yes. And from our side, yes, it is quite successful. And even from the recipient side and those who are our beneficiaries and receiving the services, I think we were very successful in Africa.
And in terms of impact and reaction, how have the governments in Africa reacted to your presence there? And how are the people also reacting to your services which you provide?
For us, the evaluation and the assessment is important. So in one way, we are providing some services, and the other way around, we need to see the impact, the consequences, and so on. So in emergency activities, for example, I can refer to 2000. 10 or 11 famine issue in Somalia, or then we had the project of the hunger resilience in Somalia and Kenya for the Somalian refugees and then displaced population who were in Kenya and the surrounding country. I could say, and I can confess, that it was really one of the largest operations we had in Africa, because in 2010 and 11 we had more than 22 different campsites in Somalia, which, the country was divided into different, let's say, parts, but as a humanitarian neutral organization. So we were both in Mogadishu, we were in Somaliland, we were in Hargeisa. So no matter where the people are living, for us it was only the consent of the different partners, I can say, the government, and also the requirements which were on the ground. So we were there, we provide our and offer our humanitarian assistance to the people.
Now, you earlier talked about the issue of the COVID-19 pandemic and the services you're providing in Africa. Can you elaborate? Because we are still in the pandemic right now.
Yeah, exactly. But when in 2020, the pandemic has started. Fortunately, Africa was one of those continent or place of the world which had less impact of the of the COVID. But at the same time, we were curious to assist those people who are in need, and because the situation, especially the medical and health situation in different countries, were not let's say suitable or appropriate. So we tried to assist those people. So we have our medical centers in different countries. Through our medical centers, or directly we could also assist, for example, in different countries like Sierra Leone or DRC. We have deployed also the hygiene items, the medical items from Iran to those countries.
Very good.
And even for the vaccination part, we also made our readiness to provide vaccines to different African countries. Still, we are in contact with some of them.
Now, you have mentioned a very important point there, that you are taking Iranian health or medical products to Africa. Now, apart from the COVID-19 pandemic, I believe you are also taking other medical products and medicine to Africa. So how are the people responding to these products which are actually made in Iran, both medicine and medical products?
I tell you interesting story. I was in West Africa, so we have clinics in Ivory Coast, Ghana, Sierra Leone, and those countries. And we also send and submit the medicines, Iranian medicines, to those countries. So I have witnessed myself, and people, when they refer to the medical center and they came to the pharmacy, they only request for the Iranian medicine.
Oh,
I asked one of the patients, she was a very, let's say, old lady, but at the same time she was a very nice, gentle lady. Yeah. I asked her, so there are lots of medicines in the country from different countries. Yeah. Why are you preferring the Iranian one?
Iranian medicine.
And she said to me directly, saying that, because we do believe that Iranian medicine is not medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So the impact and the treatment we receive from the Iranian medicines is part of our belief. And we do believe that both Iranian medical doctors, personnel, and medicines can have more impact on the health of the issue. And then we can get better and recover much more easier. So I think it is because of two issues if we want to evaluate the situation. The first one is the quality of the Iranian production of medicines, and the second one is the belief itself. So people, they think, and it has, I can say, the psychological impact on their mind. So if they use this sort of medicine,
they
will be better, and the care would be much more better to their health, let's say, issues. So for this one, I think Iranian medicines have very good, let's say, room in different parts of Africa.
Yeah. And right now, several UN agencies have warned that some African regions like the Sahel and the Horn of Africa, Somalia, Ethiopia, and parts of northern Kenya, will be facing a severe food crisis, which is, of course, a global problem, but the impact will be more severe in these parts of Africa. Now, does the Iranian Red Crescent Society have any plans to provide humanitarian assistance to these regions during this period?
The Hunger Resilience Project, which we had trilaterally with the Kenyan Red Cross, the Somalian Red Crescent, and International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent in Horn of Africa, was a very, very successful project we had, because we could, let's say, cover lots of Somalian let's say land, as well as those refugees who were in Kenya, and provide them the food security assistance. So it is nowadays, because of the development we have in different parts of the world, access to food is an issue, a serious challenge.
Yeah.
So we are in very close contact with our Red Cross and Red Crescent partners in different countries, as you mentioned, in Ethiopia, in Central Africa, or the other countries. So if they request, and either bilaterally or through the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, we can have this sort of the project in Africa, and we would be very pleased to have this kind of the collaboration with our national sister societies in African countries.
Now, and just as a follow-up to your answer there, you've talked about your collaboration with your counterpart societies, Red Crescent or Red Cross societies in Africa. What exchange programs now do you have with these societies apart from hunger resilience issues?
So we normally have a sort of the memorandum of understanding or an agreement with our sister national societies, and In the memorandum, we will agree what kind of the activities we can have.
Yeah.
So among them, I can say the training is really important. Let's say capacity building of the national society and the people is important. We also try to provide direct assistance, whether it is the food security, water, health, and sanitation, as well as the health issues. So this kind of the collaboration, normally we agree, and then based on this collaboration, we have an agreement. We define the projects, and based on those projects, we can provide the humanitarian assistance to the people.
Now, we are almost running out of time, but I'll just like you to tell us briefly, what are your plans for expansion in Africa?
Yeah, that's a good question. Expansion of the activities in Africa, first it is the requirements, of course, that are there, and then the consent of the national societies and the government. So we need to agree. For example, in Ghana, now they think that after being almost 30 years, we need to expand the medical center as a big hospital.
Yeah.
So now it is under the discussion, negotiation, how can we... we can have just recently, this week, we had a very, high-ranking officials from Ghana. They came to Iran. Two ministers were among them, and we had some sort of the bilateral discussion also to expand the activities. So in different parts of the Africa, no matter where Iran Red Crescent is there or not, but we are ready to assist more if it is necessary.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hassan Isfandiari. He's the Director General for International Operations and Humanitarian Programs at the Iranian Red Crescent Society. We appreciate his presence here, and that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Send us your comments through our social media handle, and also let us know the topics you would like to see covered here in our program. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.